Susan, also, I do feel warm at heart, although it is chilly outside, and it's the time of season where we are celebrating, and we're actually being able to celebrate a little bit more closely, physically, which is a really welcomed return to something of normal. And yeah, let's put bows on everything, because it's also Christmas time for my family, and goodness knows we want presents.
I love that. We are talking about a year that has been certainly something that we wouldn't have envisioned a year ago, or something that we necessarily have a handle on even now. Late December, things are changing, different than they were a month ago, 2 months, 6 months ago. That has had an incredible impact on the way we deliver education at HFC. Some things have changed dramatically. Some things, though, have stayed the same, consistent, current, relevant, and rightly so. Give us your summary, if you will, on what's been going on this year for those that have been a little bit out of touch, those that are listening in the community without a student, perhaps, or without being a student here at the HFC experience. What's it been like? And then certainly, what's it been like for you? Not an easy task that you've been running, managing this college.
Well, I'll start with what's most important to all of us at Henry Ford College, and that is our students. For our students, they're now in the second year of trying to earn a college education during a pandemic. And, you know, I remember college being pretty hard, but what I see today for our college students, I tend to wonder if I would have made it through. These students are trying to learn in extraordinarily different ways. They're also struggling with sickness and job insecurity and all kinds of other ancillary problems that ordinarily are just difficult on their own. But now they have people in their lives like college presidents or presidents of the United States or governors saying it's not safe to do this or that, for which we've been doing and these students have been doing for their entire life. What we're really excited about is that for the vast majority of our students, they're still grinding out. And I mean that they're really grinding to get through what is a life-changing educational opportunity. We are so proud of what we do here, but the truth is we're proud in our graduates because when they get out with a certificate or an associate's degree or transfer to a four-year degree, we know that they are five times more likely to be employed, that they will earn in some instances over $1 million more than had they not gotten a college education over their lifetime. So the first thing I'd say is students are resilient and they're still pushing through, and it's an honor to serve them. The second group of people that are the most important to us here at the college are my teammates like you, Susan, who are on the faculty and on the staff at HFC. And, you know, you and I have talked about this. It has been a grind for them also. We have had not only the difficulties of the pandemic and having to learn how to do your job in different ways, sometimes different places like your basement or your closet, but we've also had a lot of social and emotional unrest that is a weighing difficulty on one's psyche. But the truth is the strength of our institution is our faculty and staff, and they have continued to show up. They have continued to teach and work in different ways, and we haven't let down. We still continue to support students with life-changing education, amazing support systems associated with the learning process. And then, you know, those of you in the community who aren't here very often, and I would understand that because we've been somewhat shut down, there's a small army of people keeping this institution running. And some of those people were laid off at the beginning of the pandemic. Some of those people lost family members during the pandemic. It's a sad reality that we lost some teammates during the pandemic. But this team continues to provide the public service that educates in an annual year, 17,000 students at the most cost-effective and highest quality in the region. And then you asked about me. I'll tell you, when I took this job 3.5 years ago, I did not anticipate having to learn about epidemiology. I did not even guess I would understand the variants of a virus, much less the efficacy of vaccines, boosters, and masks. But, you know, just like everyone else, that's what the time calls for. And what I will say is if you out there have struggled like I have trying to get up in the morning and see yourself to a positive outlook, the one thing I've found that is always been consistent for me on that is when you work in teams, and you're doing something that makes you passionate, like public service and education, it's a go-to. It's like the best golf club in your bag. It'll hit a straight shot if you think about the people that you have as teammates that will help you and the service that you can provide for in our case, students. And so Henry Ford College continues to be the light that keeps me going.
Thank you for that. It's that mindset that you're not alone in this. One of the isolation components of the pandemic has made people feel alone, made students feel like the support network is cut off, make individuals that work now from home, that loved the interaction, feel like they're alone. But continuing to reinforce that message and continuing to make the paths to support available, I think, has been front and center in the mission that we've had as a college, that has come down to us as instructors, that we know, conveying things about counseling, about the Hawk's Nest for food insecurity, abilities to connect with the library, and so on. Those services have worked, I think, extra hard to make sure that you're not alone in this mindset is valid and valued, and I know students are benefiting from it. I see it firsthand in the classroom environment, both online and in face to face. And that's not easy to do, as you mentioned. You also talked about the strong team that we have in place. We have had some changes a little bit with the cabinet, and for those that are not incredibly familiar with how sort of the hierarchy of the college experience is on the administrative side, would you just give us a rundown of maybe the how it's working now and how you feel about what's working now with that?
Yeah, the cabinet is comprised of 7 vice presidents and my executive assistant, and they are my closest confidants, my best teammates. They are an extraordinary mix of diversity in skills and background, religion, and life circumstance. And we have a couple new teammates who have come to that cabinet. One is Holly Diamond, who is now the interim vice president of student affairs. And her job is to oversee essentially all the things that we do to support students that are not in the classroom. So the counselors, the advisors, the athletic department. And she's been a great addition to the team. And I'll tell you, I kind of feel badly for her in some instances because she's trying to help a team that supports students when students have needs and support desires that are once in a lifetime. But she's been at the institution for many years, almost 2 decades, got a lot of experience and has been very helpful in that regard. I also created a new position because I wanted to highlight the college for external audiences in a better, more cogent way. So I created a position of Vice President of Marketing and Communication, and a woman named Rhonda DeLong took that position. She was at the institution when I came here, but not for as long as Holly had been here. Vice President DeLong had been here about 2 years before I came. So her tenure here is 5 years, and she's taken on recruiting, marketing, communications. She does a lot of work helping me communicate with both internal constituencies and external constituencies. And one of the things she's been really great about is to help me continue to voice what we value in our diversity. And so if you come to our website, you're going to see statements that I put out on our diverse community celebration. So everything from what Juneteenth means to what Eid al-Adha means to what does Memorial Day mean. And this past year, we've moved from just written prose about those things, which were shortened versions of a Wikipedia article, really, to videos where I initially talked about those events. But now what we've done is just really great, especially in this time of the pandemic, so you can see and hear what these really interesting cultural aspects of our rich fabric of diversity are, is we're bringing vignettes of voices from our community talking about what their holiday is like. So our Jewish friends talking about the Hanukkah celebration, our Muslim friends talking about their traditions. And I usually show a picture of my kids climbing on my shoulders to put the star on the Christmas tree. These are things, as I mentioned earlier, that they can be the intellectual walls that we can lean on in troublesome times. And Rhonda, Vice President DeLong, has been wonderful in standing up those videos. I can't profess to you, Susan, to be as good as you or your students in media relations, but I will say, if you're interested in seeing and learning about how diverse we are as a community, those are a really great addition to our website.
Yeah, glad you brought that up. HFCC.edu, by the way, is the location that is housing all of these videos. And they're wonderful. The Diwali one was just great. It's really, they really are fun and interesting and informative. So I agree. And I'll tell you, President Cavalluna, as we are in a different mode of delivery world these days, where content is key and we're reading from screens all the time, it is kind of nice to be able to watch something instead of read about it, to still get the message. And there is just a sense of, there's an additional passion, there's an additional spark with that, that I think, you know, and my English colleagues are going to disagree with me because the written word versus the spoken word, but you know where my love is. There's just something really cool to see the expression on a person's face as they're talking about something in their culture that's really important to them. And I think it's just incredibly relatable. So really kudos about that. Really appreciate that you've enhanced that delivery of celebration to our community, not only our college community, but again, to those of you listening on our internet stream or listening on the FM dial. Check these out. They're interesting. They're cool. And it does provide not only some backstory about the diversity that we have here at HFC, but also a chance to meet some of the people that are directly connected to it that maybe you don't get to see because you don't get to come on campus so much, or maybe you haven't been here for a long time and you're former student. So appreciate that. And I think that's working very well. So that's in the plus list. That's a check plus on that one. We're not keeping score, of course, but we always want to make sure we have more checks in that side of the, you know, of the column. I've got spreadsheets on the mind, I guess. But let's remind our listeners, we're joined today via Zoom with our president of HFC, Russ Cavalluna. And we are talking about some things that have changed or altered or expanded this past year for necessary, but also very positive, proactive reasons. But also a little bit about some of the behind the scenes things that you might not know about that make up our college community. And you started with students, and I suspect we'll end with students. But in the middle still, we have so many other outside opportunities for community service, for service learning, as we call it, and opportunities for people to get involved with the college. Some of that is through direct giving. Some of that is through, you know, coming in or experiencing carryouts with the restaurant. We're hoping to get plays on campus again, you know, sometime soon. But how have you been approaching that, where it has had to shift, but still keeping that direct connection with our community? And I know if it's possible to be in five places at once, that's you. But you know, one person can only be the face in so many different environments. So what's happening there? And do you see any changes or alterations in what we're going to be doing in 2022, as far as connecting with the community through the campus?
Well, I don't claim to be able to be in five places at once, but I do claim to try. And the reason I do that is completely self-serving. It really is the lifeblood of this job for me. I truly do enjoy seeing the diversity, not only in the people, but in the activities that we have on campus and with our partnerships off of our campuses. So we are, like the rest of us, doing the best we can and trying to keep up with what is candidly just an unforeseeable turn after unforeseeable turn in these times. We're doing the best we can to try and move back to some of the things that we enjoy to do. So our restaurant is one example you've just brought up, and we do have that restaurant now, and it is open on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursdays. Not right now. We're going to wait until next year. It'll be paused now, but during our regular semesters, Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays for lunch, and then Wednesday evenings. And it's great food, and you're not going to beat the price, and you're going to help students learn how to do what they want to do in their profession. And you're going to help a local business here in Dearborn. And that's not me just saying it. I bring my kids and my wife there often. We have functions there. It is fantastic. We're playing sports on campus again. I've brought my kids to watch our basketball teams, and the men's basketball team is ranked in the nation. Our wrestling team is continuing to play, and our volleyball team also. We're also having students on campus now. So if you were to be on our campus, you would see active learning occurring, which is, for those of us in education, that is just something that makes our heart sing. But are we completely back to normal? And I know that there's an open debate about whether we ever will be. I tend to believe and hope that there is a future that looks like that, at least more than it does now. We're not quite there yet. We still have about 70% of our coursework online or in a hybrid modality. We don't have all of our staff back on campus yet. And we're trying to evaluate what is the safe way to do that. And we're doing what everyone else who's trying to serve the public or customers are doing. Masking, highly recommending vaccination for students. And we are attempting to follow the federal government's mandate on vaccinations for staff. And, you know, this is that's a difficult balance to draw. And you asked about what we see for next year. My hope is that we as a community increase the percentage of people who are vaccinated and boosted. I also recognize that that's a really hot button issue with a lot of strong feelings on either side. But I need to say, if you have friends or family who are students or staff at HSC, or frankly, just in the community who are on the fence about vaccination, I'm not here to prove to you which way to go. I am here to ask you, ask a doctor, talk to a medical professional about your concerns. I really do believe that we as a community can get more educated by folks with credible information. And I do think if that happens, we're going to have a better shot to move forward as a community in a more safe way. And I say that as a person with young children and an elderly parent. So I hope and believe that when we make progress on that front, we as a community college and we as a community will start to look more open and be able to enjoy what we really do enjoy, like concerts and graduations and walking through the middle of our beautiful campus and the trails behind it, seeing each other and high-fiving each other. And we're not quite there yet, but I do think that that's something that inevitably will happen. It's only a question of how much we can do as a community to make ourselves safe. And I recommend you talk to your doctor about how to do that.
As we move forward in the process of trying to, not just trying to debate issues, but just almost trying to be mind readers for what is going to be happening. You know, we don't have that magic, you know, thing we can look into that's going to show us what life is going to look like in 6 months or so on. And that is a variable that can be very unsettling for people that are very much involved in a mindset that needs to count on things. Then I'll change is not good. I don't like change. I know what I know, and that's the way it is. Well, certainly that's all blown up this past couple of years in the world. But as a college and as a college community, I think one of the best defenses and one of the best weapons to combat the scariness of not knowing what's coming is communication. And you talked about bringing in a Vice President DeLong in helping with external communication. But you're also doing some things that I think have been quite successful with internal communication, not only when you get to pop in and see students in the classroom, but your First Fridays events. Will you talk a little bit about what those are all about and why you decided to do it and how you feel about them at this point?
Yeah, again, this is a administrative decision that was born out of self-serving interest. And the self-serving interest is before the pandemic, I was walking around this campus multiple times a week. And in many occasions when I felt frustrated with other things, because when I interacted with people like you and your students, it lifted me up. And I was deprived of that for a long time. And so I talked to Rhonda DeLong, the new vice president, and some of my other colleagues. I said, oh, what can we do to try and get some semblance of that? And so we put together a town hall. The first one was in response to the national discussion and outcry after George Floyd was murdered. We held one on racial justice, and there were some 120 people that attended that, including our congressperson. And I got a sense, well, we could do this once a month on any topic and try to show what I describe as these kind of pillars for us to lean against, which are the social and emotional bonds that still exist despite our physical separation. So we came up with a catchy phrase, which was First Fridays, and that means the first Friday of each month, we hold an hour-long forum that is hosted on a virtual means, and anyone from the community is welcome to attend, usually students and faculty and staff, and I don't have an agenda. I usually spend maybe 5 minutes updating on anything of topic topical interest. But then I open up the floor and students and faculty can talk to each other. They can ask me questions. They can compliment each other. They can criticize me. In fact, the only rule there is I don't allow people to criticize other teammates or students by name. They can criticize me by name. That's part of leadership. But other than that, it's a forum where people talk about what's going on, ask me about why I made this decision or how we can change to improve. And it will never replicate actually seeing each other and being with each other. But it is a lot better than not having that. And we're going to keep trying to find ways to do just that until we're able to be together.
Has there been something, one thing, and now I'm putting you on the spot, particularly dramatic like sort of mind-blowing, life-altering, can't believe we didn't think of this before, what a brilliant idea or what an interesting critique of something that maybe we have been doing that has come out of some of those meetings? And I know, I'm sure you could give examples of small things probably regularly, but any, you know, something that rises to the top that you, that maybe you learned or some other people were able to learn through that experience.
Well, this isn't something that I learned and wished that I had done before. But it was mind blowing. It was more emotionally heart filling. And it was, I started encouraging people to call each other out for the things they were doing in this weird and difficult time, either just well or great or for each other. And they started doing it and they liked it. And it wasn't me. I mean, I'm, you know me, Susan, I'm a pretty big cheerleader for anything I see and enjoy here. But it wasn't me. It was students calling out by name. And that's an exception to the rule. If you're going to call someone out by name, feel free to do it if you're going to praise them. And we had students saying that, with discrete instances of faculty and staff helping these students through a pandemic. And, you know, to see that happen, human to human interaction and support and true appreciation, it made these meetings the high point of the month. Now, I will also say that, you know, part of leadership, and I truly believe this, is you got to stand in front of people and take the rocks and the tomatoes thrown at you when they think that you should. And that also happened. I won't call that heartwarming, but it's important. And I learned from that. You know, if someone has the guts to stand in a public forum and say, "Hey, Russ, we don't like that you're doing this," then I honor them with hearing it and truly understanding it. And when I have a cogent explanation for why it happened, I offer that. So those are the really great effects of that. The heartwarming part and the part where leaders need to stand up in these difficult times and own the decisions they've made and show the people they're willing to listen.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Throwing tomatoes, that's one thing. They're squishy. No rocks. We don't want to be throwing rocks. Those could do some pretty major damage, and that's not the way to do it. Russ Cavalluna is joining us today, president of Henry Ford College, and we've just got a few more minutes, about five more minutes in our discussion today. And I thank you so much for your time. I know how terribly busy you are, so appreciate making the time for us here on the WHFR Journal. We have a new administration coming in the community with a new mayor and some new council people, and it is going to be a big change, bigger than it has been in years, for the sake of, you know, a turning over of the guard, if you will, for the city of Dearborn, and Dearborn Heights for that matter. How do you feel about that? What are you looking forward to moving into this next phase with the new administration in our community?
Well, I know a few of the new elected council members. They're the two of the young men who were elected. I know them from my interactions, and they're bright, ambitious young people. And man, they worked their tails off in a weird election. Meaning, you know, it's hard to do retail politics, which is what's necessary to win city council seats. It's hard to do that when you can't touch and be around people. But the mayor-elect is the person I know the most who was elected. I know him from his time in the state legislature as our state rep. He was instrumental in helping us get $6.7 million devoted towards our campus for a building expansion. He has spoken on our campus. He's a son of Dearborn, young guy, articulate and passionate probably to his detriment. I've told him this. I said, you know, you've got so much ahead of you. You got to pick the challenges you want to try and take on, because if you take too many, you'll get none of them done. And I had the rare opportunity to give him that advice, because he asked me to help on his transition team, which has been a really interesting experience. And I'm glad to serve in that role on behalf of the college, because, you know, the city of Dearborn and Henry Ford College are two of the larger employers in our town, and our workforce and the people we serve have a lot of overlap. So I'm happy to help him in any way I can, but I'm also glad that Henry Ford College has a voice at the table with his new administration. But he's got a lot on his plate. The young guy, I think he's 31 years old, Susan. He had a baby 4 days ago, and he's going to be a very, very young chief executive in the town of 110,000 people with a budget deficit at this point. So, I'll be a shoulder to cry on, or a friend to call, and I'll tell him, send all your employees who need education to Henry Ford College, and raise your new daughter up and send her also.
Well, that's about the best testimonial for our college that I can think of, sending your children to our school. And that's really what it's about. If we want to make a difference in the community, if we believe what we say we believe, and I know we do, we have to have the opportunity to do that. So talking about it, thinking about it, yeah, one day maybe I'll go to school. Yes, I'm thinking about this school, but other schools. Talk to us, connect with us, right? Get in and see all of these things, and connect with the people that have the information that we can share to help you experience what we get to experience every day. And as I always say, and I'm 25 years plus at the college, I can't believe it, but I couldn't think of a better place to be. It is my lifeblood, and I mean that sincerely. And I know you feel very strongly yourself, but it does make me laugh, Russ, when you talk about he's a young guy, and I think about all the people that think about you and like, he's a young guy. So for a young guy to be saying he's a young guy, that just cracks me up. I can't help it. But I'm younger than both of you, at least in my mind. So I'm gonna put myself in that group. But it really is about seeing what we have to offer, feeling the vibe, feeling the energy, coming in as a community supporter and you know, connecting with us in that capacity, coming in as a student, coming in as an alum, as an employee, and we do have something special here, and I attribute much of that specialness to its leadership, and that is you at the top. So we want to thank you for everything that you're doing in these most difficult times, and even when times weren't quite as difficult to kick things off, you know, on a daily basis, to make this place a better place in the world for all of us. But also for bringing in the people that can help you do that. You know, a leader is only as good as his team, and we've all said that. We all know that in our own little silos. But we thank you for that, and we also thank you for listening when people are wanting to share opinions and feel like we've got ideas that will help make this even better. So it's a multifaceted process. That's why I call it the HFC experience, and you're leading that way. So we're grateful for that, and wish you continued success in the new year as well. Final thoughts, anything you want to, you know, Christmas wishes, anything you want to leave us with today?
Well, I do want to say to those of your listeners that Susan's being kind about my leadership. The truth is, what makes Henry Ford College so strong is we're a community college. If you come and interact with us, particularly right now, if you want to skill up, or if you have a family member who needs access to college, you're not going to find anything better than the faculty you're going to interact with, like Susan McGraw and like the other individuals at this campus who are dedicated. It's their life's passion to help students find a better life through public education. And that's really what is moving this institution forward in a really difficult pandemic. So the last thing I'll say is, Susan and I were talking, before this, and you mentioned correctly that people are worn out. People are tired of what this pandemic has done. And I'll tell you, for those of you listening, there's an antidote to this virus, and it is public education and taking care of each other. And you can find both of those things at HFC. And if you ever want to hear or know more about it, I'm easy to find, and I'll talk your ear off about it, as this interview has shown to be true.
Thank you. If somebody listening wants to reach out to your office, we certainly always encourage them to check out the website. So much information, such a wealth of information. One thing that's gotten better during this pandemic has been our website. So very appreciative of that, as it needs to be always the front and center for information. And that's hfcc.edu, simply put. But to reach you directly, how should we share that news?
Well, you can email me at rcavaluna@hfcc.edu, which is a mouthful. So if you just search president at HFC, you're going to get an email that comes up. Or you can call my office, which is 313-845-9650.
President Cavaluna, thank you so much for your time and attention. We wish you success in the new year. We wish you the happiest of holidays, and we really thank you for being with us today on this, the WHFR Journal. We've got more on the way. I'm Susan McGraw. Please stay with us, WHFR.FM. We are making waves.
If classical is your genre, WHFR is the place to be in the late night hours until 10 a.m. 7 days a week. From Beethoven and Mozart to Bach and Brahms, let it lull you to sleep at night and wake you up in the morning. Or for you night owls, enjoy the soothing sounds of classical music all night long. 89.3 FM or WHFR.FM on your computer. Make WHFR the station for classical.
It's Ideasphere with author and technology history professor Peter Norton. Autonorama.
When a place is accessible by car, it tends to be less accessible in every other way. It gets harder to walk there because of the wide roads. It gets harder to ride your bike there because of the fast cars. It gets harder to take the bus there because the destinations get further and further apart as the location decisions assume that people are arriving by car.
Several automotive companies are currently working to perfect autonomous vehicles. Their promises for high-tech driving includes crash-free mobility, elimination of congestion, and lower carbon emissions. The problem, as some see it, is not in the technology, but the vision itself. Hello, I'm Guy Rothbun. Welcome to Ideasphere, a platform for today's voices. Inter-technology historian Peter Norton. His argument is that driverless cars cannot be safe, not sustainable, and it will not be the solution that automakers claim. The reason, he says, is that car dependency itself is the problem. In his book, Autonorama, The Illusory Promise of High-Tech Driving, Norton says that the impossible dreams of a driverless car are distracting. That's because we already have affordable, sustainable transportation technology. Norton uses a historical perspective of the future to show how, once again, we're being sold car dependency in the guise of mobility. For starters, he reasons that high-tech driving will never reach zero crashes, and congestion will be worse in the future, not to mention worsen social inequities and emissions. Add to that, he reveals how autonomous mobility is really just high-tech data collection. Peter Norton is associate professor in the Department of Engineering and Society at the University of Virginia. His previous book is Fighting Traffic, The Dawn of the Motor Age in the American City. And he joins me for this program. Peter, thank you for this time.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Guy.
Looking forward to this conversation because we as consumers have been hearing so much about the automated vehicles that are coming our way sooner than later. It seems as though it keeps being pushed back in the distance. You see this as part of the problem as much as it is part of the technology.
Yeah, with promises, you can lead people along for a long time. And when people start to doubt you because you haven't been fulfilling your promises, sometimes you can just point to some impressive state-of-the-art technology and say, well, here's why you should believe my promises now, this time. And here's why you should forget about all the broken promises and, that I've left behind. So, yeah, I think that's how it's been working.
Car dependency, that's a central point that you have throughout your book. It flows in every aspect. And generally what you're looking at is our society is so embedded in car dependency that creating an AV, automated vehicle, along with all the technology is just going to increase the dependency.
That's right. I think there's a really important distinction to be made because I'm often told that I'm against cars. And I say, no, I'm not against cars. I'm against car dependency. I'm against having an environment where everybody has really no good choice except to drive. And I think of this autonomous vehicle showmanship as an attempt to perpetuate car dependency because so far it's never really worked well. So one of the ways in which the people selling us car dependency try to keep us buying it is by convincing us that the next generation of technology will finally make car dependency work. What I'm trying to say is cars work, but car dependency does not work, and nothing will make car dependency work.
This is an issue that you address as well, because that dependency is where you turn it back on itself and say, all right, let's take what we have now and improve the conditions through the technology we have. In other words, the transportation is there. Let's use it.
Yeah, that's right. I think we have far more good choices than we're being told. So we're being shown the choices that would entail buying a lot of stuff for a very long time to a rather disappointing result, because that's the profitable choice for the people selling us our future. But we should be choosing the future we want, and there's really impressive stuff, high-tech, low-tech, and no-tech, that can get us to a better future, and it takes people choosing instead of the sales forces choosing for us.
In case you're just tuning in, I'm talking with professor and author of the book, Autonorama, The Illusory Promise of High-Tech Driving. This book is now available through Island Press in hardcover. It's a worthy read if you're interested in this transition into what is being foisted upon us. I think this is necessary to get a perspective of what it really means. You have a website or blog you want to pass along?
Well, I mean, the only thing I've really got like that is a web page on my university's department, and that can easily be found if anyone Googles my name, Peter Norton plus University of Virginia.
Okay. I'll have that available at Public Radio Exchange. You can go there now and hear the program from the beginning, or you can just click on the link that you find there for the university website for Professor Norton. If you have any questions, write to me at rathbunproductions@gmail.com. You look at the autonomous mobility as high-tech data collection. It's interesting that my wife triggered on this many, many moons ago, saying this could be an issue for consumers, that we have to be aware of how we might be used.
That's exactly right, and I'm impressed that your wife spotted this early, because I think she hit on this way before I did. It took me a while to see it coming. And the way I got to see this angle of it was by looking at what the companies are busy telling each other. So an autonomous vehicle would be very expensive, and it would be very hard for the companies to either sell us a vehicle or sell us rides in a vehicle without charging an extremely high amount of money. So what they've done instead is figure out how to make autonomous vehicles, and they're working on this now, into something like a phone, whereby often without wanting to, you find yourself using it more than you meant to, because the people who are collecting data from you want to keep you scrolling on your phone. Well, the vision for autonomous vehicles by many of the tech companies and automakers developing them is to turn them into sort of mobile, what they call the ultimate mobile device. They mean like a smartphone on wheels. And they're talking about equipping these things, particularly the ones that would work like taxis, into vehicles where you would sit in them and there would be immersive high-tech games or other entertainment systems that would have you fixated on using them. And perhaps, and they're actually hoping this, hoping that you would end up in the vehicle longer than you meant to, generating more data. One of the CEOs of one of these tech companies said, data is the new oil. By that, he meant that this is very profitable. And he also meant that the vehicle occupants, you and me, are the oil well, and we're going to be pumped and mined, and then the data will be collected and monetized and used to entice us to consume more, because this is what makes data so profitable, is they can use it to sort of entice us or tempt us to spend more money than we meant to. When we think of an autonomous vehicle, by that I mean people who aren't in the industry, we're likely to think of it as a way to get from one point to another, from a point of departure to a point of destination. But what a lot of people in the industry are saying is that it's really just a way to collect data, and they'll have that transportation element woven into it to make it more attractive. But to them, it's really a data collection device, not a transport device.
Yes. Something you mentioned there, in the expense of these vehicles, it's also going to create a wider gap in our societies. There are people who are not going to be able to afford these vehicles, no matter how cheap they become, it based upon the technology that's being used.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Now, there are people who are talking about having them be free to ride in, but as we've learned from our decades of experience with digital technology, is that when the service is free, then we are the product, right?
Yes.
So we have to be careful about that. But the technology is expensive. The LIDAR that the car, it's like light radar that cars use to map their environments as they're going, typically costs about as much as the vehicle itself. I've heard prices for these vehicles in the $100,000 to $300,000 range, depending on the vehicle. And they simply can't be that affordable. And it's pretty incredible how much technology they talk about equipping these vehicles with just to get people to the post office or the store or the grocery store or work. I mean, it shouldn't be such a high-tech thing, but the technology they're talking about is really expensive. And we know how to move people, how to help people get to destinations at far less expense and much more simply as well. We can already do that.
We can do that. And if we put people into electrified vehicles with all the gadgets that go with it, as you point out, we don't have the electrical grid to handle all of these vehicles. We need to be 100% renewable.
That's right. So the climate experts tell us we have to get to carbon neutrality by about the middle of this century, which is very hard to imagine how we get there. Electrification's an essential part of that, but for electrification to really deliver that, we've got to also reduce the amount of energy we consume so that the share of the power grid that is provided by renewables can grow. And if suddenly we are, say, doubling our demand on electric power grids, we will not be able to increase the share of the grid that's provided by renewables. So we do have to be careful about electrifying vehicles. We can have electric cars, but electric car dependency is not a solution.
Something that I'd like you to spend some time on is how we are getting the pitch. And we're hearing it constantly, whether it's from Elon Musk or General Motors, whoever it's coming from, that these vehicles, by the time they hit the roads near us, will be perfectly safe. Very low level of collisions. There's a problem with that assessment.
There really is. The number one selling point for these vehicles from the early days, I mean about 20 years ago when they were really being worked on seriously for the first time, is that they would make our roads safe. And in fact, the early estimates or the early promises were that they would eliminate car crashes almost completely and eliminate all the fatalities. We have 38,000 people dying on our roads every year, and clearly that's intolerable. And this becomes a way to sell autonomous vehicles. And there's a very clever but misleading message that we get. And I think sometimes the message is sort of honestly mistaken, but more often I think it's misleading in a deliberate sense. By that, I mean the people selling these vehicles subtract all of the human failings that we as drivers commit that makes driving dangerous. So I'm talking about driving fatigued, driving distracted, driving intoxicated, being impatient, being distracted, and so on. All of these things make us far less than perfect as drivers. And of course, the robotic systems that control autonomous vehicles won't get tired, they won't get distracted, they won't get drunk, and so on. And so the sales pitch has been that we can estimate their safety by subtracting all of those human failings that robots don't have. But what they don't do in making this sales pitch is add in all of the failings that robots have as drivers, and there are many. Robots, for example, have a very hard time figuring out what a puddle is or what an oil splotch is on the road pavement. They're very bad at anticipating what others will do. This is one reason why the people selling us this future have tended to prefer to talk about a future where all of the vehicles are autonomous vehicles, because that's much easier to solve on paper or on a computer simulation. But of course, we can't transition from zero autonomous vehicles to 100% autonomous vehicles. There has to be a mix. And because of the costs, that mix would probably have to go on basically forever, because we simply can't afford to have everybody in autonomous vehicles. And so we have, as a result, robotic vehicles that make bad judgments because they can't sense their environments entirely correctly and they can't anticipate human actions well. And this fact gets terribly compounded by another factor, which is that there's a lot of competition among these companies to be the leader in autonomous vehicles. And when there's intense competition, playing it safe is a losing proposition. So any company that promises that their vehicles will take no chances at all is going to be stuck, because their cars will have to go slowly, cautiously. They'll have to apply the brakes very often, because there's a, let's say, a 1% chance that something it perceives is a pedestrian, and so it'll have to brake for that pedestrian. In other words, if the vehicle is cautious enough in its programming to actually be safe, it will be a loser in the competition for passengers. And the companies know this. This is why, for example, the Uber that was in autonomous mode with a human safety driver at the wheel struck and killed a pedestrian 3.5 years ago in Arizona. It's not because the technology couldn't detect the woman, Elaine Hertzberg. It did detect her, but for reasons of business necessity, Uber had to program the vehicle to take chances and to not brake every time it sensed something. And therefore, you know, in effect, the people of Arizona were the experimental test subjects of Uber.
My guest is technology professor Peter Norton, Autonorama, the Illusory Promise of High-Tech Driving. He is associate professor in the Department of Engineering and Society at the University of Virginia. His previous book is Fighting Traffic, The Dawn of the Motor Age in the American City. Check out his website at the University of Virginia Engineering Department. This is Ideasphere. I'm Guy Rothbun. We'll be right back.
Technology moves at the speed of innovation. And today, that's lightning fast. So when you get your hands on the latest tech, don't forget to do the right thing with your old devices. Recycle them. The Consumer Electronics Association and its members are making recycling your old tech device as easy as purchasing new ones. Just go to greenergadgets.org, type in your zip code, and you'll instantly find the responsible recycling location closest to your home. You'll also find lots of tips to simplify your recycling, like asking the store where you buy your new TV if they'll haul away your old one. Television sets, video game consoles, smartphones, tablets, they're all recyclable. Don't let them clog up your local landfill. Just visit greenergadgets.org. You're sharp enough to get the latest tech tools into your home. Now be responsible enough to get your old devices to the recycler. That's greenergadgets.org.
We're back with IdeaSphere and technology history professor Peter Norton, Autonorama. Peter, you bring out something that we should all be aware of, but I think we overlook it in this excitement. And of course, the builders do as well. You call it highway hypnosis. If we're going to have non-driver vehicles, but passengers in the vehicles, they're not going to be paying attention to, well, it's distracted driving, but hey, we have an autonomous vehicle here. On the other hand, if there is an emergency of any sort, failure of equipment, blown tire, you point very quickly to the hypnosis that has the danger signal.
That's exactly right. So, and this goes back a long way. Highway hypnosis is an old word, and it was used to describe the effect of being on a featureless straight highway for a very long time. And that highway is meant to be safe, and because it has a shoulder and nicely painted lines on it and so on. And those efforts to make that road safe are also an unconscious message to the driver, saying to the driver, you don't have to pay super close attention here. We've designed this road to be safe for you. And therefore, psychology says that the driver's attention will start to lag because there's just not much to pay attention to. Now, when you put in a lot of high-tech automation, some of it is certainly beneficial in terms of safety. But what I'm trying to say is it's not all beneficial because there's a counteracting effect. Once the technology is sort of implicitly promising to the driver that the technology is making everything safe, well, then the driver starts to, whether they want to or not, be a little less vigilant than they would otherwise be. Of course, this takes an extreme form in the case of a vehicle that's in autonomous mode, like the Uber that killed Elaine Hertzberg was, because then you're really reducing the driver only to a sort of security guard almost on the watch for anything wrong. And because ordinarily nothing at all goes wrong for hours and hours and hours, well, human beings just are not very good at paying attention to nothing. The notion of putting a human safety driver, as the companies like to call them, behind the wheel of a automated or autonomous vehicle is just not much help because that human being is psychologically not well equipped to keep paying attention and to be ready, as you put it, to step in at a moment's notice. Because if something does go wrong, 2 seconds may be all the time you have to respond.
There are so many issues here that we could address, one in which is you're very capable of giving us a metaphor that provides a direct link to what you're saying about the excitement behind the electric car, that is tobacco. The same conditions that were used to sell people on tobacco are being used for AVs.
That's true. The parallels are sometimes, to me, rather chilling. when the Surgeon General's report of 1964 came out, the famous report that said smoking really does cause cancer and heart disease and other life-threatening illnesses, the response of the tobacco companies was, initially, they had already by then tried casting doubt on the research by sort of just throwing up smoke screens of questions. By 64, that hadn't worked anymore. So what they did instead was promise people that their cigarettes were safe. And to make this claim credible, they put on initially some very impressive looking filters. In fact, a lot of the ads in the 60s and the 70s show you blueprints of cigarette filters that invoke the aura of science. They look impressive. We know now, as they knew then, that they really accomplished almost nothing. To get a satisfying puff on a cigarette, you had to just draw a little harder, and you got the harmful inhalants as you got without the filter. But the parallel is striking in the following sense. The cigarette filters made the cigarette seem like it was not your old school cigarette. This was something new. Science had reinvented the cigarette as something safe and enjoyable. We are seeing that same kind of repackaging going on with the automobile, because while the automobile has some deep inherent flaws in terms of moving people efficiently in cities and in terms of safety, in terms of emissions, in terms of traffic congestion, and so on, if you put some very impressive technology in it, people start to believe that car may be actually sort of categorically different from its predecessors. The truth of the matter is it still takes up at least 100 square feet, a lot more when it's moving at speed. It still takes a lot of energy to move it because it's still a heavy vehicle. It's still expensive. It still contributes to traffic congestion. In other words, the autonomous vehicle retains all of the major disadvantages of conventional cars, but the technology gives it the sort of illusion of being in a next generation class of cars that's no longer the heir of all the deficiencies of previous generations.
In your final thoughts of your work, what you do is take your reader to the sense of technology and what it can do for us in so many avenues, but you look at the other way as well, saying it's public policy, laws, engineering standards, prioritizing these parts of our needs first.
That's right. So if you want to give somebody a means of getting around in the USA today, giving them a car really is, for most of us, the best thing you can do. And that's not because the car really was the right tool for that job. It's because we rebuilt America around the assumption that if you're going to a destination, you're going by car. Our state departments of transportation, and this is true in every state, substantially equate accessibility with accessibility by car. So a destination is considered accessible if you can drive there. The side effect of that is when a place is accessible by car, it tends to be less accessible in every other way. It gets harder to walk there because of the wide roads. It gets harder to ride your bike there because of the fast cars. It gets harder to take the bus there because the destinations get further and further apart as the location decisions assume that people are arriving by car. So if you redesign the laws, if you redesign the engineering standards around the assumption that everyone's in a car, which is where we are now, then we turn the car into this sort of practical necessity, no matter how deficient it is as a real transport tool for people.
You brought that out in your previous work that I hadn't mentioned at our break but intended to, and that's Fighting Traffic, a book you wrote a few years ago, The Dawn of the Motor Age in the American City. And you talk about exactly that, that the pedestrian was secondary to the automobile initially.
Yeah, so that's the sort of extraordinary thing, if we go back far enough, is that there was a time in America when the predominant mode of getting around in a city was on foot, sometimes on a bike, particularly in the 1890s, there was a bike craze, or on an electric streetcar. And in fact, these were not totally different ways of getting around. Walking and electric streetcars were sort of components of the same system. By that, I mean the electric streetcar made it practical to walk to everything, because when two destinations on your walking journey were too far apart to walk, there was almost always a streetcar that would take me there. Of course, the streetcars were what we now call EVs. They were electric vehicles, but they did not need batteries because they drew their power from overhead wires, which really simplifies the problem and also frees us from having to get the cobalt and the lithium and the nickel that's causing so much trouble around the world. But this arrangement was an obstacle if your business was to sell cars to everybody. And by the 20s, the people who wanted to sell cars to everybody figured out that in cities in particular, that would take changing priorities and prioritizing drivers and streets, because until then, pedestrians had had the priority, and changing the engineering standards to favor cars and driving. In the 20s, they really succeeded at that to a remarkable degree.
Peter, there's so much more. I don't want this conversation to end just yet, but we're out of time.
Yes.
There's so many.
That happens.
That happens. Thank you. This has been such a pleasure.
Guy, it's been my pleasure. I appreciate your interest in this subject, and it's been great talking with you.
It's great talking with you. Thank you so very much, and I hope we can talk again sometime.
That would be great, Guy. Thanks for your call, and have a great day.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye. My guest has been technology history professor Peter Norton, Autonorama, The Illusory Promise of High-Tech Driving. Norton is associate professor in the Department of Engineering and Society at the University of Virginia. Check out his website at University of Virginia Engineering Department. If you have any questions, write to me at rathbunproductions@gmail.com. This program is a distribution of Public Radio Exchange, exchange.prx.org. For Ideasphere, I'm Guy Rathbun.
Listener-supported, non-commercial radio from the campus of Henry Ford College. This is WHFR Dearborn. Featuring local and independent artists.